This is the Skirted Roundtable. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings.
And this is Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8.
And Joni Webb with Cota, Texas.
And this week on the Skirted Roundtable, we are welcoming interior designer and newly published author James Swan of the brand new book, 101 Things I Hate About Your House. So James, thank you for joining us at the Skirted Roundtable.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
We are connected on Facebook, and you've been publishing, I think, some of your tidbits for a while on Facebook. But let's start. Why don't you actually tell us about your background? I think people like to know what people's backgrounds are and your business and that kind of thing. And then we can talk about your book.
Absolutely. Born and raised in Northern California, just a simple boy from Sacramento. Fell in love with design probably in high school. With my first subscription to Architectural Digest, and finally found my way into the study of architecture and design. I did my master's work in both at Arizona State, and landed in San Francisco in my first design job, and have been doing it pretty much nonstop ever since. Opened my own firm in Beverly Hills in 1999. And have been doing custom residential interiors around the country under my banner ever since then.
So are you based in L.A., in Beverly Hills?
The office is in L.A. I have a house in Maine right now that I'm having a love affair with. And I'm spending more time in Maine right now than I am in Los Angeles. But that's probably going to change as we get a little further into the summer. It looks like I'll be dividing my time pretty evenly between East Coast and West Coast.
I was wondering about that. How did that happen, Maine? It's on the other side of the world, you know, from L.A.
Literally and figuratively. It was as part of the book writing process. My writing partner, Carol Beggy, and I had reached a point with the book where we needed, and we were writing it from opposite sides of the country. Carol is based in Boston. I am based in Los Angeles. We reached a point where we knew that we needed about a week face-to-face across the table from each other to reach an objective that we had in writing the book. And long story, slightly shorter, if she came to Los Angeles, she knew too many people, we didn't get anything done. If I go to Boston, I know too many people. And mutual friends gave us a lovely gift of their summer house on Pemaquid Point in Maine and said, the house is yours. It's remote. There's no internet service there. There is a dial rotary phone.
Wow.
And you're welcome to it. And we took them up on it. And I fell in love with this little village. And before I left that week, I had found the house that I'm now living in. And 4 months later, I was moving my things in and starting to play house in Maine.
Where is it in southern? I'm just curious. Is it southern Maine?
Mid-coast.
Okay.
I'm an hour and a half north of Portland, and I'm about an hour south of Rockland, right on the water.
And the book is great, by the way. We have all three looked through it. How did you start? Did you have that particular idea in mind, or what was the very beginning of the concepting?
Well, the very beginning really was shooting from the hips, and if I'm quite honest about it, was slightly influenced by some really great Merlot. We were at a dinner party in Boston, and I had been asked the question, so when are you going to do a design book, Jim? You've been at this long enough. My response was that I wasn't really interested in doing the design books like everyone else was doing at that time. I just didn't feel highly motivated to do a big coffee table book filled with, you know, admittedly beautiful rooms, but not necessarily rooms that would impact people's lives. It was just a book of pretty pictures, and it just didn't really interest me. And that doesn't mean that I don't love those books. I've got a library full of them. I collect them regularly. But as something I wanted to invest energy in, it didn't really resonate. And so I was pushed a little bit further later in dinner, I think after consuming some more red wine, and I really shot from the hip, and I heard myself say, well, if I did a book, it would probably be titled, oh, I don't know, 101 Things I Hate About Your House. And everybody around the table laughed, and we went on with dinner. And Carol Beatty, my now writing partner, pulled me aside as we were leaving dinner, and she said to me, you realize what you have done. And I said, I don't know what I've done. I honestly didn't do it. she laughed and she said, "No, you've come up with an amazing title, and now we really need to write this book." And that's where it began. And
I have to say, the title is fabulous, you know, and it's really, because I've been seeing it come out, and, you know, it interested me. It reminds me of, I don't know if you ever heard of Bill Stubbs. He's from Houston.
He wrote
a book, and it was entitled, "I Hate Red, You're Fired," or something very, very, you know, like that.
I had that book, yeah.
And he had, you know, done this house in all red, and the client goes, I told you I hated red, you know, and so...
Yeah.
But I really, it got me thinking that the title is so important because, you know, this 101 Things I Hate About Your House really grabs you.
It does. And I mean, as I've put my toes into the water of the publishing world, a foreign land to me by any accounting, I continue to be convinced how important the title is as I've begun to market and promote the book. We've worked really hard to fill the book up with a lot of great humor and a lot of great information, hoping to empower people. One of the things that we realized when we really sat down to start thinking about this project was the huge percentage of people in America who will never, under any circumstance, ever hire me or any of the professionals that I call peers. It's just not part of their life dynamic. And yet, a vast majority of those people care greatly about what their home looks like and the way they live their lives. And I really found what I really wanted this book to be was my opportunity to try to share a little bit of the knowledge that I've been able to gather in my career with this huge, huge swath of people in our country and hopefully make a positive impression on the way they live, the way we all live. It's not brain surgery, and we can have beautiful homes if we are just willing to work a little bit at it.
I love the way you angled it. You came in from the back door. You know, you're not, as you said, you wanted to do something different, and you did. And I think this is what people want to know. What am I doing that I really shouldn't be doing? Mm-hmm. And you know, and I love that. And you're not just cutting it down, ripping it to shreds. You're actually going back and saying, this is why this doesn't work. This is why you shouldn't do this. You know, and it all has good reason and it makes sense. And some of it is, you know, maybe subjective, but come on, it's true. Nobody likes a wadded up dirty napkin at a table. Go the extra stretch and do cloth napkins, you know?
Okay.
I mean, things like that, they're so little. And I think that in a book format, it's so good because people can sit there secretly in their bed and read through it and not feel embarrassed and take in the information and go, okay, and swirl it away. And so it's really valuable from that perspective.
The title is very provocative. Have you had any pushback from people?
You know, it was our greatest fear. And when we finally got a publisher, we had one conversation about it. They wanted to hear me talk about the title. They understood what a good title it was. There was, however, that word hate in the title, and they were a little concerned about it. And I've only had one blogger speak negatively about the book, and her angle was coming from the title. She really took issue with this idea that I had put hate in the title, and she just couldn't get beyond that.
You know, I think let's just explain to the audience, because it's a very different design book. It's more of like a handbook with straight ideas, where he takes room by room by room, like
from
your entry
right
hall,
from the front
your
door.
Powder room, your living room, and there's a point by point by point of everything you could think of or the right way to do it. You know, it's kind of like a how-to book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's illustrated with drawings, but only one photograph for each room. So it's mostly a wordy, you know, it's a book you read.
Right.
It reminds me of the early Charlotte Moss books a little bit.
Oh, my gosh, what a compliment. Thank you. that's very, very sweet. And, yes, it is a book that is to be read. We did go back and forth with the publisher. I mean, my original idea was that the book would have no color photography in it, that it would only be illustrations. I found our approach to be, one, I wanted to engage people's minds. I wanted to challenge them to the idea that they could create a more beautiful home to live in. But then I found it odd then that we would fill up pages with rooms that somehow defined what the perfect living room looked like. And to my way of thinking, if I were a homeowner and if that was my position and I was looking to this book for help, well, my living room's never going to look like that living room, so why would I even bother? So I felt it was very important to stay away from a heavy presence of the color photography. We chose to illustrate things to keep the entertainment level high. I think the illustrations are just breathtaking. My dear friend Stan has done such an amazing job. And I hope what they do is fuel the imagination and simply just become jumping off points for people to then go and create their own most beautiful living room or dining room or bedroom. And in that sense, really become empowered in falling in love with their home.
Well, I think one of the things that, for me, the illustrations do is they do soften the title. Because I have to say, it was a little bit of a turnoff for me initially to like to see the on Facebook. But when you see it in the context of it, and the illustrations are humorous and light, so it's sort of like, oh, it's not... It's not
negative. It doesn't put you on the defense.
Right. There's a humor there.
It's like the title just brings you in, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the content. The content is very positive.
Yeah.
Not negative.
Yes.
Right.
Because the title says something personal. I hate about your house. And so I think people will kind of, as Linda said, it's provocative. It provokes people to pick it up and go, really? Yeah. And then you start reading it, and it's all done in a very friendly way and a very helpful way. And really, it's good information. So you sort of, there's no way you can sort of put it away. You kind of want to keep looking through. Do I do this? What is there anything in here that I've done? I totally did that. I told my husband earlier today, I said, okay, I'm reading this guy's book. And we have two big dogs. And I paint my front steps constantly white, and they get scratched up. And I said, I have to be even more crazy about this, because he's so right. That really is a first impression. And I cannot have these dogs scratching up these stairs. If I have to paint them every month, I'm going to do it, because he's so right on about that.
Yeah, you got me with the front door. I was like, oh, my front
I
door.
I know.
So bad. I don't know. I was like feeling so bad.
Me too.
See that. It's I'm a dog person too, so I have dogs and my front door, front and back door for that matter. I'm constantly, constant. And I think that's the reality of this. And when I'm with groups of people, we just had a book signing in Boston last week, and it was wonderful. About 75 people gathered, and we had a really great time. But the thing about it is that we're all cut from the same cloth. We all face the same challenges. And we all overlook a lot of the same things. So this is a challenge for me too, because God knows when I have people over now, you better believe I'm on the spot, because they're walking around with a book saying, okay, does it really do this or does it really do that? But again, it's part of life. We're not all going to be perfect all the time, but it's the idea of just caring enough, loving our homes enough to put our best foot forward. What more can you ask if people are doing that?
James, are you going to be coming through LA doing a book signing? You may have already done it here.
We did a small one in May at Barnes & Noble down in Santa Monica. Yes, we will be back. We will be back. I'm going to forget the dates. I want to say that it's in late September, and then we've got a return visit just before the holidays to Los Angeles. So
I'm there.
Plenty of opportunities.
James, I thought what we could do tonight was maybe take a chapter and discuss the points, that you make in the book about.
Well, we start off, you're right. To one degree or another, every home has a powder room. Some of them do double duty as family baths or kid baths. But when guests come, there is that place that we direct them to freshen up. And it's the second chapter in the book. And so to me, to my way of thinking, it's a very important room. Much like the entry hall, it's all part of that first impression. And so for the first point that we make, we refer to it as a lightly powdered disaster, is just the idea of clean it up. I cannot tell you how many homes that I go into, whether it's in a social context or in a work context, And the amount of paraphernalia left out and about in the bathroom, or the bath that's designated as the powder room, it just is mind-boggling to me. It's such
the toothbrushes and
toothbrushes and the makeup and
the bad soap. That's you touched on that. That's one of the points.
So if we do nothing else, I have this saying on plaques in the office that we create a place for everything and everything in its place. And if we work with that idea in mind, then all of that paraphernalia, all the things that we all need to put ourselves together and get out the front door in the morning, there's a storage place for it. Plastic bins, baskets, cabinets, closets. Let's just put it away, particularly when there are guests coming over. Then there's this idea of playing hide and seek. It never fails. Paper products in bathrooms run out. And whether it's the toilet tissue or whether it's a Kleenex, when they run out, where are the backups? It should be in a simple, close, logical place, but oftentimes it's not. And we're left to our own devices to rummage through every cabinet and every closet in close proximity to try to find that backup roll or that backup box that we need. So as a host or hostess, make the job simple and prevent that whole, you know, pillaging that goes on when a guest is in a panic. I mean, let's face it, it can be a panic moment. And then there's the issue of scents in a bathroom. It's the simplest thing. I mean, I can drive into my little village here in Maine and go to the corner five and dime store and walk in there and I can buy a scented candle. There's not an excuse that anyone has for walking into a bath, into a home in general, but certainly into a bathroom, and there not being a scented candle, maybe with scented spray, because we all have those moments when our bodies just do those strange, silly things, and we don't want to be embarrassed or be embarrassing.
That's my big tip, is every time I have a party, I always put a candle, you know, in the powder room lit.
Mm-hmm. And it's a sign of a gracious host, the person that has thought that through and taking care of their guests in that way. The next one is just one of my, just makes my skin crawl. I have a real problem with rugs that have that rubber backing on them. Now, I'm all about safety in a home, and I'll be the first one to make certain that we always have non-skid pads under every rug. But in general, rugs that have rubber backing on them are just hideous.
They're just hideous,
and they should be expunged from every home in America. And I'm sure that there's a whole, you know, segment of the manufacturing industry that's going to be after me for that. But when you've got so many options in the marketplace, beautiful hand-painted rugs, antique rugs, kilims, I mean, on and on and on, the selections are out there. Buy those, invest in something that's going to heighten the experience of being in your home, put a non-skid pad underneath it, and let's go about our business. But enough with these rubber-backed rugs. They're just awful. And then soap. Oh, my gosh. Nothing is, and I'll use a junior high school term here, nothing is more gross in the world than a wet, slimy, gurgly, bar of soap sitting next to a sink. And it never fails. I walk into a powder room, and there it is. So
sitting in a moist pool.
He says, it matters not how lovely the brand or how delicious the dish is. This gurgling mass is fermenting. The muffly glob of mush is unsightly. It's really a funny book.
I know. And you've got to take that dish and wipe it out and put a brand new bar in. That's what I do if we're having a party or something like that, because I don't want a slightly used bar of soap. I'm kind of funny about that too, James.
I even take it a step further, and that is that I recommend and have found a great love for liquid soap. And I find the most beautiful dispensers for the liquid soap. And then, yes, I have a beautiful dish that also sits by the sink. And in it, I put a beautifully wrapped bar of soap because I think that looks beautiful. And I happen to like to collect soaps when I travel. I always am buying up soaps. But I give my guests the easy and I think the more sanitary version of the liquid soap to use, and I think everybody's the better for it. But that's just my opinion.
But you take it out of the store bought container, correct?
Oh yeah, by all means. I mean, there's very few that I don't, but. I think Jo Malone may be the one brand that I will use the liquid pump bottle that they sell it in. But I've got a collection of lovely containers that the liquid soap goes in that matches the bathrooms in the house. But yes, the liquid soap is what people tend to feel most comfortable using, and it's what I would prefer them to use. Let the beautifully wrapped bar of decorative soap be just that. Something beautiful, something decorative.
And then I think it's important that you put in the section about how do you use the monogram linen towel, hand towel? How do you go about that? Because I think a lot of people do get confused about what they do with that.
It's a terribly confusing thing. My mother has called me on the beauty of the cell phone is, of course, your mother can call you from any place. And she's, Jim, I'm at a party and I'm really confused. I don't know what to do. I said, well, Mom, if the paper option is there, opt to use that. Allow the beautifully starched and pressed linens to be just decorative. And people don't know. And to some extent or another, it sends mixed signals. I have clients who take great pride in their collection of fingertip towels. And so they like to have them on display. And then they have the monogrammed, beautiful quality paper Hostess towels that they really want people to use. And I have the conversation. I said, well, you're sort of sending mixed messages here. Which one do you want your guests to use? And, you know, at the end of the day, it's their home and they're going to dress their bathrooms the way they're going to dress them. My recommendation, and I've gone to this in my home, is I do one or the other. If I put freshly starched linens, fingertip towels out, then that's what I'm intending my guests to use that night. If I have out my monogrammed paper host towels, then that's what I'm intending my guests to use. I don't put both of them out because I do find it confusing. I get confused. I confuse easily. I admit to it.
Okay, now Megan skipped over a point, if we can go back to it, about the lighting, which I found real interesting.
Well, a lighting in a powder room is... A lighting in any room is probably my greatest and most consistent item that I take people to task over. The impulse to overlight a room is just criminal. And it's criminal for one reason only. Nobody looks good in blinding light.
Right.
None of us. The reason that Merchant Ivory films over the years have always been one of my favorites, and I think people's favorites in general, because everybody looks so doggone good in them. Those wonderful period piece movies. And the reason is they were filmed in candlelight.
Yeah.
That I think is the objective when we're setting lighting in a room, particularly for a social evening. I mean, if you're coming in the day after and it's time to clean things up, of course we want to bring all the lights up to their fullest. But my goodness, let's create the illusion and support the illusion with beautiful candle level light in a room. Nothing is worse. I tell the story of one of the presentations that I do of going to a new restaurant in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and it was a very, it was an upscale restaurant and it had all of the reviews, and we had to book reservations 3 months in advance, and we finally got the table and were seated, and at some point during the first course I slip away and go to the gentleman's room, and I literally screeched like a junior high school girl when I walked in the men's room and the lights came on, and it was like being at center court at Wimbledon. It was so overly lit. And I went out and I called the maitre d' over and I said, I am leaving this restaurant unless you do something about the lighting in that men's room. And he looked at me like I had lost my mind. And I said, you can't expect me to sit in here and pay $250 a head for dinner and be assaulted by the lighting in your bathroom. You can't be serious about it. Oh, yeah. It's horrible.
Yeah, you know, my everything's on a dimmer. My house is so dark all the time, and my sister's the total opposite. I go to her house, you know, like for family dinner, and everything is, I don't understand it.
I don't either.
doesn't get it. I don't understand. She loves everything lit up like a Christmas tree.
The mindset that I do not understand either. I was raised in a house. I mean, we were not Catholic by religion growing up, but we used to tease my mother about being Catholic because of all the candles in her house. But we were just raised in that wonderful sort of golden glow of candlelight. And it's the light that rooms look the most beautiful in. It's the light that people look the most beautiful in. So why would you have it any other way? Just
right.
That's my mind.
Right.
Let's see, where are we at now in our little chapter? Oh, in books, yes. I'm a great one for putting fun and funny little books in my bags. I just love it. I find that it's a sort of a pleasant surprise to share with my guests, and I encourage people to do the same thing. I think that's just a gracious touch that a host can give by finishing out the baths in a house with simple little fun books that can make those moments that we all have as we're idling time away just a little more pleasant with a bit of humorous reading. So that's how we end up with wrap the chapter up.
Can you name any of the books that you think are particularly...
Well, I pick them up at, you know, tag sales and used bookstores all the time. I think one of my most recent... Oh, goodness, I should just walk into the bathroom and pull some of these titles. It was a late 19th century book on risque escapades is the title of it. And it's these really, they're really quite funny when we read them today. I'm sure they were quite salacious at the time. But these were salacious and scandalous snippets taken from, I guess they would call them, not the want ads, but the personals in the newspapers of the London Times. And they're just quite hilarious. I have a little book on skiing right now, why skiing is the most dangerous sport in the world. And it's just wonderful little observations on the dangers and the humor in strapping wood poles or wood boards onto our feet and hurling ourselves off a mountain. So,
really?
Yeah. If it's odd and unusual and unexpected, I'll usually pick it up, and you'll probably find it in my powder room.
And then the end of the chapter is illustrated with a photograph of a beautiful powder room.
Yes,
we love this powder room.
One of my favorite powder rooms. A wonderful client in Southern California is kind enough to let us use this picture, and it is. It is in many ways an idyllic powder room. It may be maybe too much for some people, but it's certainly fitted out in a beautiful way and speaks to sort of the ideal that we're after about a well-appointed powder room. And that's how we end the chapter.
I have two questions about this room. What? Explain to me that side table.
Sewing table.
Yeah, is that what's underneath?
Holds your sewing.
Oh, got it.
Yeah, it's a little cloth basket that drops down beneath the table. And in this instance, it was the original fabric. Beautiful little Biedermeier table.
And then what's framed above it?
Framed on the wall was a collection of coat of arms, coat of arms. There were, I think, 33 of them that we ended up framing and decorating the walls of this little powder room with.
Really pretty.
Beautiful.
I think this was fun. Let's choose one more.
23.
Furniture pushed up against the wall. This is one of my favorite illustrations in the entire book. We speak in this little introduction, draw the parallel of that wonderful, well, not so wonderful, but that horrific scene from the movie The Exorcist many, many years ago, when furniture is spinning and flying all around the room, and then it all gets slammed up against the wall. That's the impression, that's the level of horror that I equate when I walk into a room and I just see all the furniture slammed up against the wall.
Like a centrifuge.
Exactly. It's just it's just pinned up against there by the powers of the universe. And I just always encourage people to, you know, I really think people do that because they don't know any different. It's never occurred to them that by moving things away from the wall, you can create small intimate groups for conversation, and it just makes the whole experience of being in the room much, much more pleasant. But I do encourage them to do that. Houseplants are the bane of my existence. Now, having said that, I love a beautiful orchid plant, and my house is full of them, but spindly, uncared for, long forgotten excuses for plant life don't belong anywhere in anyone's home. I just don't understand why people just don't chuck them and be done with it. And yet, my mother is the greatest...
Horticulturalist?
Not a horticulturist. Hoarder, I guess, when it comes to plants.
Horticulturist.
No matter how dead the plant is, she just can't quite let it go to get rid of it. And I think homes just pay the price, unfortunately. Getting plants right. If you're going to have plants in a home, there are things to keep in mind. One is scale. I love a beautiful 8 or 9 foot fiddle leaf fig in a beautiful basket in the corner of a living room. It's tall, a huge, massive statement. But a spindly little, light, leafless, lifeless twig in a pot stuck in the corner just doesn't have the same impact. So houseplants are, you just really have to be careful with the houseplants. When you get them,
well, saying that, what do you think about fake houseplants?
I find there's no excuse for fake houseplants.
Yeah.
I've been wooed over by a couple of manufacturers of silk flowers, and I've been suitably impressed by their quality and their beauty. But this is the funny thing. What I don't understand with people who insist upon using silk flowers for arrangements in their home, okay, if I come into your home and, you know, it's we're now the last minutes of June, I don't want to come back in your home in October and see the same silk floral arrangement sitting on that table.
I know. And then, you know, you don't even see it after a while. You know, you just... Your eye doesn't see this fake arrangement. It just, it's such a mess.
Which is usually dusty by that point.
Oh,
yeah.
And I think that's why this book works so well, because so many people, by reading that, makes you walk around your house going, oh my gosh, I do that. I didn't even think about that plant. I was just trying to get it back to life again.
And life happens and we forget about it, but... we can make our homes more beautiful by just addressing some of these simple little things, like getting rid of that spindly little plant that should have been thrown out months ago. And my challenge to people who do use silk flowers in their home, if those flowers were real, they would be changed out every 2 weeks in my home. So I dare you to do that with your silks. Take the arrangement apart, rearrange it, bring something new in, but give your family, yourself, and your guests something fresh and new to look at, certainly every 10 days to 2 weeks. I don't want to come back in 6 months and see the same arrangement in your house. That's inexcusable. Let's see. What comes next? Oh, absence of, you know, I don't want to sit down. Nobody wants to sit down in a chair in a comfortable room, sipping a drink or a cup of coffee, only to realize they have nowhere to place it. It's amazing to me how many homes have comfortable chairs with nowhere to place a book, a drink, a cup of coffee. So I have the sit and reach rule. For any seating to be successful in a home, sit and extend your arm. And if underneath your hand isn't a table of some sort, you need to rethink the furniture arrangement.
Well, what I want to know is, when did parents start thinking that their children couldn't be around a coffee table? Because you get so many young clients with young children, and they're like, oh, I have to wait to get a coffee table, my child, you know, because of my baby.
And I never did that.
That's the darndest thing.
Or they wrap the coffee table with this big Band-Aid.
Right. But at least they have one.
At least they have one. Yes, I would rather have something wrapped or, you know,
baby
bumper. I understand you don't want sharp corners, but my God. We've all lived to this ripe old age, and I grew up in a house. I'm trying to remember I think my mother had glass coffee tables when I was wee and little.
But seriously, does anybody know anyone that poked an eye out on a coffee table ever?
Right. Someone make a comment, but but it's true. I mean, I've never heard of anyone, and yet. So many people just are like, oh, because I think they want their kids to be able to run around free. It's like, oh, in the living room.
These are the same people that don't want drapes in their living room because their child, they swear, is going to climb them.
They think they're going to climb up them, yep.
Yeah.
I've actually laughed in a client's face when they said that to me. I really did.
Sadly, I met a woman. I did a brief consultation for a woman whose kid did destroy the drapes because they.
Well, that's her fault.
It was her fault. I raised two little girls
to respect their surroundings, and most of the time it worked. No one got hurt, but most of the time it worked.
Yeah,
there's a few scribbles on the walls here and there, but that was about it. They got in big trouble.
Right. Sometimes things happen.
And you have great stories to tell about that, don't you?
I do, yes.
But back to the book, I think that's great, the sit and reach rule, that you should go around your living room or your family room where you have guests and, be sure there is a spot to put a drink down, So it's elementary, but people don't think about it.
They don't. And I've done tests. I mean, just they're not terribly scientific tests, but in my own home, at a big party, I have in the same living room set up identical swivel lounge chairs. One of them I've removed the tables around it. The other I've made sure that tables were next to it. And at any time during the party, I can go into that room. People will be sitting in one corner of the room enjoying themselves where the tables are. Where the tables are not empty, you could shoot a cannon and not hit anybody. People subconsciously gravitate towards areas where they know their needs are being met. And a good host thinks that through, thus the sit and reach rule. So.
Plus, it ain't, a small little garden stool or an unusual, like an African drum or whatever, it anchors the chair and the floor plan, and it's right, and
it's a great opportunity to do something, interesting.
Right.
Why wouldn't you want beautiful little tables around? The fireplace and the hearth is a source of great sadness for me in many, many homes today. Even in new homes where we're dealing with gas logs and all of that, I don't have a problem with gas logs, but if we're going to be asked to buy into the illusion of a beautifully appointed hearth, then give me a wood basket, give me tools, make me believe that there's going to be a roaring fire there at some point, or just don't bother. And unfortunately, so many people just don't bother. And it rings untrue. It rings of a hotel room to me. And that's not what we want to be feeling.
But no, wait, I'm not getting what you're saying. If you do have a gas log, you're saying to add the tools, so even though you wouldn't use them?
Absolutely. You're asking people to believe, whether it's gas or not, you're asking, there are certain ideas that are sort of seared into our minds, into our conscious, about what a fireplace is all about. There's an emotional connection that we want to have with that, the center of the house, the hearth, sort of the cradle of civilization, and all of these things. I mean, think about the movie images of fireplaces that we've all grown up with, and those images are not complete without the wood basket, without the fire tools. I don't care if you push a button and that log jumps to life with a gas flame. Create the illusion and finish out that scene. I mean, you would no more not dress out and detail your coffee table or not create a beautiful tablescape on a table, and yet people will ignore those details that finish off the fireplace. So consistent.
Yeah, see, I'm guilty of that. I am. I have a gas, and I don't have the tools next to it or any of that. So
I had been too, and it was a very kindly client of mine came to my home once. This was years ago, and just asked the simplest of questions. Why? And it's something I'd never thought about. And I began then encouraging my clients. We were in Southern California there. I mean, I think Orange County, I forget, it was 5 or 6 years ago, there was a moratorium on real burning logs, on being able to burn logs in fireplaces. And so we were faced with lots of gas logs. And I just encourage my clients to continue to dress them out as if they were fully functioning fireplaces, just for no other reason than to finish the look and to make the room complete. And we keep getting asked back to do them over and over again. It really works. It makes a huge difference on how people perceive and experience the space.
Mm-hmm.
And then windows and window covering.
I love this chapter.
Yeah, this one. So many people just don't think it through. And I understand that we are moving to a simpler way of life, and the window coverings that my grandmother had, the curtains that I grew up with, multi-layers, you know, a shade layer and a muslin layer and the actual curtain itself, those days may be on the way out, but there was wisdom in what they were doing with that sort of configuration of window coverings. I can't tell you how many people are perfectly clueless to the idea that someone outside their house, if I can see out, they can see in. And many, many clients who I'll visit at night, and we'll be having the conversation, and I'll just take them by the hand and we'll walk out to the curb, and I say, turn around and look at your home, and it's just like a fishbowl.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything that goes on. So at bare minimum, some sort of sheer diffused layer in those windows to provide for the basics of privacy for your home. It's just so important. Not to mention that it eliminates those black panels of glass that we get when a room is lit from the inside but not from the outside.
Yeah, that's a pet peeve of mine too. Like, when if you don't have light, if you're inside the house and you're having a party and you don't light your backyard, you're just looking at black.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Black mirrors.
You know, so I always say, put some tiki lights out, or go get, you know, I have Christmas lights.
Little Christmas lights. Yes.
That I keep on 24/7, you know, in my backyard, and just
to create balance. And now, and that works wonderfully for life in the suburbs. But when you're in the city and you're in an apartment, particularly in high rise, you get the light of the city that helps a little bit, but it's really difficult to mitigate that black mirror effect, those huge panes of glass just reflecting back everything that's happening in the room. So again, a thin gauzy veil might be the approach to help mitigate that. They're just things that people need to think through, and unfortunately, many people don't. So hopefully they will. Wasted real estate. None of us, you know, I live in a nicely sized home, but I use every square foot of my home. And I make sure that each room has real use. I grew up in a home where we had the formal living room that was only used twice a year. And I think that that's just unfortunate. And I don't think in today's way of living that a lot of us have that luxury of being able to just have room after room after room that just sit and wait for a special occasion. So I put great emphasis on the idea of making space work in a smart and intelligent way. And I think we get the best use out of our homes when we do that. And then the room without a soul, my gosh, please, please spare me from rooms that I walk into that show absolutely no signs of life of the people that live there. Photographs, kids' artwork. I find it so funny that I'll visit a home, do a consultation, and mom and dad will run around and make apologies for all the kids' art that's around. Don't apologize for it. Celebrate it. Those are really important people in your house, and their work needs to be shown off, and we need to come up with interesting and innovative ways to display that work. I don't necessarily believe it has to be magnetized to the face of the refrigerator. I think there are other options. But I want to know about you. I want to know the books that you love. I want to know the places you've traveled. And I think your friends do too, and certainly your guests in your home. It makes for a much more enjoyable experience as a guest to be able to have a sense of who the host is through the collections of photographs and books and objets around the house. So I encourage people to show me your stuff.
That's really true. You know, like my living room, I mean, no one ever goes in there except to get the mail, and my dog lives there, you know? And I think, what can I do to make this room more alive, you know? The only thing I can think of is, or more, to make people in my family use it, and I think of a TV, you know? If there was a TV in there, people would sit in there, you know?
Right.
But I don't want to put a TV in there, you know? So that's hard.
It is. I mean, and it really takes some study to understand, you know, what needs are represented by the lives that live in the house, and then come up with creative and interesting ways. We converted one family's living room into sort of a living/library room.
Yeah.
We put docking stations on a center table. And it became the area that the kids did their homework in the evenings. And it really proved very successful for that family for the way that they lived their lives. But it was much better than it just sitting there and only being used twice a year.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like the dining room. You have Christmas, you have Thanksgiving, and you have to seat your family somewhere. And so you have this dining room that never gets used. I mean, you do sometimes have to have spaces in your house that don't
aren't used all the time.
Need a lot of use, but you do need that space, you know. So,
and that's the concession that we make. But I think the point is that we come to that realization after thinking it through and realizing that, okay, this is a special sort of a public room. I'm going to only use it 3 or 4 times out of the year. And maybe we allocate our decorating dollars accordingly. We want it to look beautiful, to be comfortable, but maybe I'm going to spend a little bit more money somewhere else, or maybe not. But it's the idea of making conscious decisions that I think empowers people, rather than just letting things happen because, well, that's the way it's always been done in my house.
I also think that it's indicative of having the luxury of space. I have lived in... I've had 3 houses that all had formal dining rooms, and one of the houses, the one I lived in before moving here, was a large 3-story old Victorian in Boston, and moving from there, downsizing into this, I'm in a beach bungalow, I'm in a beach cottage that was, you know, designed in the 40s, and we use every last bit of space. And so I think about how, wow, in my last houses, I had dining rooms that, like Joni, you were saying, that we were really only in 3 or 4 times a year. And that was it. It was such a luxury to have those rooms to kind of, you know, keep in perfect shape when they're not in use and elegant. I like that.
Yeah, I bet you do miss that, Megan.
I do. I mean, especially a formal dining room. Oh, what I would give right now for that.
Well, they're fun to decorate, and they're, you know, fun to use. I mean, I would use a formal dining room probably more. Just why not just use it?
Dinner parties. I love formal dinner parties.
Yeah.
Or even just breakfast for 2, but just, you know, just use it. I'm sort of a big believer of using the things you have.
Mm-hmm.
Not just, you know, that's just for special. I mean, every day could be special.
That's so interesting that you say that. I was just having this conversation with a client here on the East Coast. And she's decided that with their 3 children, that dinners, I think her initial impetus was going to be every night she was going to do dinner in the dining room. And I think what the reality is, it's coming down to Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. But she's using the formal dining room for her family as part of their dinner ritual. And
we did that every Sunday night.
We did that
at my house. I mean, we ate in the dining room. And my parents still do every single night, unless maybe a Sunday night or Saturday they eat in the breakfast room, but they eat in the formal dining room every night.
Yeah. My parents do too. China.
It really is. And I think it has its place in our homes today. Certainly no reason not to, particularly if you've got the space. My goodness.
Well, that's when I was growing up, that was our Sundays, and it was part of it was sort of training us how to, you know, not be heathens, basically.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was Sunday
to
be able to be amongst the grown-ups, and it was jackets and ties for my brothers and father, and, you know, we put our Sunday dress clothes back on for dinner, and it was in the winter, it wasn't really in the summer, but it just taught us, you know, good manners, and the boys standing for my mother, and that kind of thing, and it was nice, and we used a room every week.
Yeah.
So we're coming to the end of almost an hour, which I know, it's been great. If you had to leave people with sort of, you know, one or two things, you have to do this, of your 101, you know, you have to do these one or two or three things that'll make such a huge difference right away.
Lighting is easy right off the top. Put dimmer switches on every switch in the house. Put dimmers on your table lamps and your floor lamps. I'm a huge fan of, you know, 40 watt bulbs, pink bulbs when you can find them. Line the interiors of your lampshades in pale pink silk or gold foil to help further soften and diffuse the light. Lighting can make a huge difference in a house, so that's always where I start. Buy comfortable furniture and learn how to arrange it in the space that you have. Think about intimate conversations and how you can arrange that furniture to encourage that. And I think maybe last, and maybe it's an overall, but fall in love with your house. It's a huge part of our life. It's a huge investment. The care and upkeep becomes a huge ongoing commitment. Be passionate about your house and make it as beautiful as you possibly can.
All right. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really, really fun, I think. You know, fun and a lot of great tips.
I've had a great time, too. I so appreciate being a part of your Skirted Round Table.
This has been the Skirted Roundtable with Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8, Joni Webb from Cote to Texas, and I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings. And this week we're joined by interior designer James Swan, who discussed his new book, 101 Things I Hate About Your House. James is giving away a signed copy of his book, so join us at skirtedroundtable.blogspot.com and enter our contest. Or you can download our podcast from iTunes, search for the Skirted Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be back soon.